2012, March 1st, today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 39, The Drake Equation. Well, yesterday we talked about the definition of intelligence, or at least we attempted to make a definition of intelligence that is not meant to be a complete description of intelligence by any stretch of the imagination, but had a sort of utilitarian appeal to it. It was, what is a useful definition of what we consider intelligent behaviors that we could use when we then want to go out and actually look for searching for intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? This brings us to numerical exercise, a form of quantitative reasoning referred to as order of magnitude estimation, that is, that leads to something known as the famous Drake equation. So today what we're going to be exploring is the question of intelligent life and the possibility of intelligent life by way of using this order of magnitude quantitative reasoning called the Drake equation. The Drake equation is nothing more than simply a way to estimate how often we expect, or in the better way of putting it, what the Drake equation describes is, in the present day, how many intelligent communicating advanced civilizations do we expect there is in our galaxy right now? Not an integral over the entire history, but kind of an instantaneous measure right now. This is going to be not just simply a guessing game. There are observational inputs to the Drake equation. These include things that we can actually measure about the properties of stars and the properties of our Milky Way galaxy. For example, the rate at which new stars are being formed and concomitantly what the frequency of planets is. It used to be that all we knew was up to the star formation rate, but of late, of course, as we've seen in the last couple of lectures, we are learning a great deal about how often those stars are formed with planetary systems. These are the firm observational pieces of the Drake equation, but we're going to see that other pieces of the Drake equation are on less firm empirical footing, and we have to actually rely on reasonable estimates or conjectures on such topics as how often life emerges on such worlds, how often intelligence emerges. When intelligence emerges, does it emerge in technologies that are capable of communication? And finally, we have to ask questions about how long those civilizations will last. It's not enough to achieve radio communication and decide on some other technology that goes silent, or perhaps the civilization no longer exists and doesn't live long enough to send out signals. The bottom line here is that even if we take and adopt some very, very optimistic estimates for the things that we actually don't have good measures of today, putting all these pieces together is going to demonstrate that the possibility of there being intelligent communicating life in the galaxy is pretty small. It's actually expected to be fairly rare. But there are some caveats, as we're going to see towards the end. So that's why we don't end the class with this, but this becomes a starting point for our discussions of trying to now reach out and ask, are there intelligent civilizations elsewhere in our galaxy? There's lots of ways to address this problem. Okay, we could take what I would call the science fiction route, where we simply state a series of uninformed opinions that sound good to us and are culturally informed. We want to actually address this question with questions we think we can answer scientifically. And the Drake equation is one of those ways to begin to address this question, asking, what is the frequency of life on other worlds? So this is the big question. Is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? That's the thing that everyone, I think, would really like to know. What do we mean, however, by intelligent life? It may not be, if you just have a series of bacteria, that's certainly life in the universe, but you can't have a very enlightening conversation with a mat full of bacteria. So how do we define intelligence? And this is a summary of what we talked about yesterday. Intelligent life in the context that we're interested in is an advanced technological civilization, one that actually uses tools, can manipulate electrons and atoms, are capable of transmitting and communicating across interstellar distances with electromagnetic radiation, which is the only way we know of to communicate information in our universe, that they are potentially capable of interstellar travel by spacecraft. We are capable of that, both of these today, but whether we do it or not, or whether we can do it with great efficiency is a different question. We can unquestionably build spacecraft that can leave our own star. We can unquestionably and have, in fact, built radio transmitters capable of sending intelligible signals across the vast gulfs of space. Finally, another characteristic of an advanced technological civilization is, in fact, interested in finding and in communicating with other intelligence elsewhere in the universe. I would say, given the amount of public interest in this topic in our world, that this is an unqualified yes, certainly for our own civilization species. In fact, when people find out I'm an astronomer, basically the very first question they ask me is if I think there's life on other worlds. Then, of course, they ask me about black holes and the Big Bang Theory and things like that. But intelligent life, extraterrestrials, is the number one question I get asked with a bullet anywhere out in the general public. Not surprisingly, we're equating what I mean by intelligent life with us, because these are the characteristics that we share. So it is a somewhat provincial point of view. Now the question, of course, is, do we in fact qualify as intelligent advanced technologies and intelligent beings? Well, you've got to wonder sometimes whether some of us are intelligent. Turn on television, you might want to turn it off right away. We've certainly had radio communications technology for about 100 years, a couple summers ago. My wife and I were on a hiking trip through Cornwall along the southwest coastal path, and one of the places along that coastal path is a little monument to where Marconi transmitted the very first transatlantic cable using wireless technology, as it was then called. And certainly for 100 years, we've been producing a tremendous amount of electromagnetic radiation leaking off of our planet. We have, for the last 50 years, somewhat appropriate given this building we're in is named for astronaut John Glenn, we've had somewhat limited, short-duration manned spaceflight. We've actually sent human beings away from the gravity of our own planet. A number of those men have actually walked on the surface of a nearby celestial body. We have also sent robotic spacecraft now out to the very edge of our solar system. We have landed on the surfaces and returned pictures and samples, or at least returned pictures and local samples of the conditions on a number of planets. We are poised to actually return rocks and other samples from other planets, meaning other than the moon. And in the past few years, some of those spacecraft, particularly Voyager 1, Voyager 2, and the Pioneers, are clearly on trajectories that are breaking away from the gravity of our sun, and they are heading into interstellar space. And within a few years, we will in fact cross that boundary. In fact, we are already, the Voyager 1 spacecraft is sending back information from its last remaining plasma experiments on board that it is now in the transition region between interplanetary and interstellar space. It can see the change in physical conditions that occurs when we are about to cross the boundary. And one of the reasons why we think, even despite our own limited experience with intelligence, that intelligent life must have arisen elsewhere is an argument based on sheer numbers. Let's take, for example, our own Milky Way galaxy. Our own Milky Way galaxy has 200 billion stars. This is a number we've done a few times. It's interesting that in addition to there being 200 billion stars in our own galaxy, it's just a coincidence that there are about 200 billion galaxies in the visible portions of the universe, meaning those portions that we can receive light from. On average, we're a somewhat large galaxy as these galaxies go. So if you took the average size galaxy, it has about 100 billion stars. So 200 billion galaxies with 100 billion stars, just making a quick estimate, there are 2 times 10 to the 22 stars in the visible universe. That's 20 billion trillion, to lay those numbers out in words. Even if we only had one chance in a trillion of one of those stars harboring intelligent life somewhere in the visible universe, 1 trillionth of 20 billion trillion is 20 billion possible sites for life throughout the visible universe. Of course, most of these galaxies are very, very far away. The nearest galaxy to our own of any comparable size, the Andromeda Galaxy, is more than 1 million light years away. So we would like to actually look for life somewhat closer to ourselves in a system that we can probably pin this down to. But there's no reason to suspect, at least to a first approximation, that the types of estimates we do for our own galaxy will be any different in any of the other few hundred billion galaxies running around the visible portion of the universe. So the question I want to address today, and this lecture is basically one long math problem in some sense, but a very well-motivated one, is how many advanced communicating civilizations are there in our galaxy right now? That's the number I want to come up with. Carl, why don't you bring the lights up for just a second here. Before I dive into this, I want to work a very simple word problem with the rest of you interactively. So here's a starting question. How many people are asleep right now throughout the world? And you in the back, wake up. How many people are asleep in the world right now? How can we estimate that number? Well, let's start with how many people are in the world. How many people are in the world right now? We'll call that N sub P. What's that number? Somebody? 7 billion. That's a good number. How many people of those 7, how many of those 7 billion people are asleep right now? How do we estimate that? What's the fraction of the number of people who are sleeping? How would I estimate that? Yes, sir?
People are asleep about a third of the time.
About a third of the time.
So 1/3 times 7 billion.
Okay, so he says 1/3, which I'm guessing you're estimating because the average person sleeps 8 hours during a 24-hour day, correct?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. So the number of people who are asleep right now is the number of people times the fraction of people who are sleeping. And that will work out to about 1/3 of 7 billion. And since we're doing just an approximation, we'll say that's a little over 2 billion people. It's really 2 billion and a third. So 2 1/3 billion people are asleep right now. That's a lot. Okay. How many of those people who are sleeping right now are wearing pajamas? I mean, real, honest-to-goodness pajamas. I mean, not, you know, repurposed action wear. Or, you know, and we won't go into the other possibilities because this is a family class. Okay, Carl, you do the count. How many of you wear pajamas? I got to turn my back. There's some things I just should not know about my students. What fraction? Just give it as a rough fraction, Carl. Oh, come on, don't be embarrassed. No one raised their hands. Okay, someone must wear pajamas. I'm going to make a rough guess based on things that there's going to be a fraction who wear PJs. And basically, the fraction of people who wear pajamas, I'm actually told, is about 1/5 of the population. I'm not saying, you know, the full thing. Topsies, bottomsies, some mix, whatever. Okay, so the number of people who are wearing pajamas is this 2 billion times a fifth. Just to make up a number, that's about 400 million people. Now, what fraction of those 400 million are wearing flannel pajamas? Okay? And of those flannel pajamas, how many of them are wearing pink flannel pajamas? You can see how I can contain this calculation by coming up with an estimate of what reasonable estimate of the fraction is. I could probably learn that from the U.S. Pajama Marketing Board. This one we all get because it's a number we all know pretty securely, and this squares with our experience of life. So using a very simple bit of order of magnitude quantitative reasoning, I can get pretty reasonably accurate measurements of the number of human beings who are sleeping in pajamas right now, and it's a couple hundred million. But if I started narrowing that down by narrowing the criteria, pink flannel pajamas with red polka dots and built-in bunny slippers, that number is going to shrink. This is, in outline, the same problem we're going to have when we try to estimate the number of communicating advanced civilizations in our galaxy right now. And the person who first really laid this formula out is Frank Drake, who is one of the pioneers of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and the former Dean of Natural Sciences at UC Santa Cruz, a school that Carl was an undergraduate at and I got my graduate degree from. It's this big, scary-looking equation, but we're going to break it down here much the same way we broke down the number of pink flannel pajamas problem. The number of advanced communicating civilizations in our galaxy right now is going to be given by the rate of star formation, how often are stars formed in our galaxy, what fraction of those stars have planets, the number of Earth-like planets that occur in a planet-bearing system, the fraction of those Earth-like planets in a planet-bearing system that are capable of harboring life, and we've already described what that meant. It's an Earth-like planet in its habitable zone. Of those that harbor life, what is the fraction of life that has developed intelligence by the definition we saw yesterday? What fraction of those are capable of have developed communications technology that we can work with? And then a final number, because a rate is a number per time, I've got to have a time scale in here, and that is L, the lifetime of an advanced civilization. How long does it transmit radio radiation? Obviously, if it's no longer living, it's no longer transmitting. So this is the way in which Drake decided to formulate the question. He did it a little differently. Here we started with the number of people and then worked down through fractions. What Drake did was work at the rate of star formation instead of the total number of stars, and then multiplies by a lifetime of a civilization. This formulation is actually a fairly useful one, as we're going to see. The Drake equation is a tool. It's a way of making an estimation. It's not going to give a right answer, any more than any of us believe that the number of people in sleeping in pajamas right now is 400 million on the Earth. But it's probably in the ballpark. And that's the point of the Drake equation. What's the ballpark look like? And then we can compare that. What are the implications of that ballpark estimate? So let's go. The first piece of the Drake equation is R star, the rate of star formation per year. We actually know that number. We can measure it for the Milky Way. In fact, we can measure it for other galaxies. A reasonable estimate of that star formation rate can be gained by taking the number of stars we see in our galaxy right now and dividing by the approximate age of the galaxy. We won't go into the details of how we do that age dating. We talk about that a little in a class like 162, but it can be estimated with reasonable accuracy. The answer is to approximately there are about 100 billion stars. That takes into account those stars that vanish. And the age is about 13 billion years. So the star formation rate to achieve that is about 7 stars per year. Now, I use this instead of the present day rate of star formation, which is about 1 star per year, because this actually averages over the history of formations of stars in our galaxies. We find that the galaxy has not been forming stars at a constant star per year rate. The fact that the number of stars divided by the age of the galaxy is about 7 stars per year is telling us that in the past, the star formation rate would have been higher, but today it's settled down to a steady state rate. So this number is kind of a time average over the lifetime of the galaxy, and it works out to about 7 stars per year. So I'm going to slightly rewrite the Drake equation here now to a form familiar from our pajamas example by talking about the number of stars in the Milky Way, but dividing the lifetime of a civilization divided by the age of the Milky Way. In other words, this is another fraction. What fraction of the age of the Milky Way does a typical communicating advanced civilization live? All right. Let's start working our way down through the numbers. The first of those is once I get the number of stars to go looking at, I want to know what fraction of stars have planets. That's F sub p. The currently observed number is about 15%. That's a number based on trying to correct for the planetary systems we see and then try to make some estimate of how thorough our surveys are. That number has probably got a pretty big range. It could be as low as 5%. It could be as high as 50% by some estimates. But this, remember, is an observational estimate based on the number of planets we know of now. And what we're finding now are mostly the gas giants. But the gas giants are not likely the most likely ones to be looking at. So an optimistic estimate, and I'm going to add an optimistic estimate, that approximately 50% of stars have planetary systems. This is not crazy. In fact, there's some indication from the data that we possess. This is probably not a wildly optimistic guess. In fact, that 0.15 number could be as high as 0.2 now, is certainly beginning to grow, and it's not implausible. It's at least half. Optimistic, but that's okay. So of all those planets that have stars that have planets, what fraction of those planets are Earth-like, meaning Earth-sized planets? Doesn't matter where they are, they're just Earth-sized. We don't know this number, but I am pretty confident that in the next decade or so, the observational programs now in progress will probably allow me to put that number up on the screen here if I'm still giving this lecture when I'm 61 or whatever. Now, this depends a lot on just what the real detailed distribution of rocky planets is. We know that for one Jupiter-sized planet, or two Jupiter-ish planets in our solar system, there are 4 rocky planets, 3 of which have plausible mass ranges for potential habitability. Venus just happens to be too close and too hot. Mars happens to be too small and too cold, and Earth is being just right. So we know that it isn't just simply a one-for-one deal. So right now, we don't know this number, so I'm going to make an optimistic guess. And this guess is based on what we think we know about planet formation. The giant gas planets that we see all probably formed with rocky and icy cores that built up large gas shells. That is consistent with the gas planets we observe in our solar system, and it is consistent with the gas planets we are observing in those systems that have been studied in sufficient detail to present to actually confirm that they are similar to Jupiter and Saturn in their gross structure. If that's the case, then the amount of raw material necessary to build those up would have more than enough left behind to build even the relatively modest complement of terrestrial planets we see in our own system. So I'm, again, going to make a very optimistic guess here and say that when you have a planetary system, you have at least an Earth-like planet in that system. Whether it's in the right place for habitability is a different question. Now, my motivation for doing this is whenever I set those numbers to 1.0, I'm basically trying to establish an upper limit. I'm trying to say it has to be at least this much, remembering that pessimism takes you down from that number. I have no real firm basis for this, but I have a reasonable expectation that this is the case. And over time, some confidence is growing that that number could be as high as one, but it may in fact be a very large fraction. And there's reasons based on what we know about planet formation and what we're starting to find with Kepler, which suggests that this is not completely nuts. It's optimistic, but it's not nuts. So we have the number of stars in our galaxy, the fraction with planets, and the number of times when you have a planet, you have at least an Earth mass, at least one Earth mass planet in that bunch. The second piece is what fraction of those Earth-like planets have life. This is currently unknown, and it is really highly conjectural. But we have some guidance from the history of our own planet. We know that life arose within about 100 million years of the end of the epoch of heavy bombardment. In fact, it looks like there's a possibility that whenever you have liquid water in abundance on a stable planet, life will almost naturally emerge if the necessary prerequisites of raw materials, carbon chemistry, liquid water, warmth, and not too much ultraviolet radiation hold on your planet. You're not too hot, you're not too cold, but you're in that habitable zone. So again, we want to set an upper limit. Since I have no way to guess at the half level, I'll say optimistically, we'll say whenever you have one of those Earth-like planets, if it's in its habitable zone, life of some form will emerge. It seems very optimistic, but again, our Earth had a very unoptimistic, very pessimistic, and violent past, and yet life got a foothold very, very rapidly once things settled down. Now we get into the slightly more highly speculative questions. What fraction of life that arises is intelligent? Very difficult to come up with a guess for that. But again, we have some clues that give us some guidance. We know that the first life on Earth, the first stromatolites that we see in the fossil record, arose 3.8 billion years ago. The first multicellular life arose just in the last 1.2 billion years. Recognizable animal life occurred with the Cambrian explosion, which was about 550 million years ago. Land colonization proceeded less than 100 million years after that. Human beings, recognizable Homo sapiens, appear in the fossil record about 100,000 years ago. Ancestors to Homo sapiens appear as long as 40 million years ago. The first appearance of real human, recognizable human artifacts, the products of the human intellect, things like abstract representation, appear in the record approximately 40,000 years ago at the oldest. So while it took 100 million years for life to emerge on the Earth, according to the fossil record that we possess, that gives us a reasonable confidence that if life is going to emerge on a planet like the Earth, it will emerge. It still took 40 times longer for an intelligent species, namely us, to emerge. So it takes a long time. So we're going to make trying to make an optimistic estimate, and I'm going to go with a wild guess. And the wild guess is that the fraction is 1/10. Could be it's a lot rarer, or it actually sometimes takes a lot longer. That's a fairly optimistic guess. If you take this number, 1 out of 40, this 40 times longer, should be 1/40, which is a much smaller number. It's 1/40th. It's about 0.025. But I'm going to give it some benefit and say that if conditions were not so violent, perhaps the ancestor of Velociraptor, the descendant, of Velociraptor, if it hadn't been clobbered by the asteroid 65 million years ago, might have achieved intelligence. There's some indication, highly controversial, that the encephalization quotient of the species of dinosaurs that include Troodon and Velociraptor at the end of the Cretaceous period had encephalization quotients perhaps as high as 4 or 5. And remember, the human encephalization quotient is 7, and dolphins are around 4 or 5. So if that frankly speculative and controversial idea is correct, then there's the fact that the velociraptor did not become an intelligent species was simply an accident of history, meaning being in the wrong planet when the wrong asteroid hit it. So I'll call it a tenth. Now, once you develop life, how often, and develop intelligent life, how often does that intelligent life develop to have advanced communication, meaning having what we defined last time as advanced technology? We know that the rise of science, the rise of technology, the rise of cultures that support technological advancement are very recent developments in human history. If the first appearance of notable artifacts of human intelligence appear in the record of, you know, cave paintings 30,000 years ago, what we recognize as scientific reasoning, real technology, the basis of that, the intellectual basis of that, arose no more than 300 or 400 years ago, and the technology that we recognize as modern advanced technology arose only in the last century. Now, that this arises at all entails both the ability and the willingness to try to make sense of the world in terms of logic and physical principles. It was that interest and will that led us ultimately to the ability to go beyond tools that were simply extensions of muscle power, to begin to conquer first chemical energy in the form of coal and oil, followed that by atomic energy in the modern day. We can now manipulate electrons. In fact, it is the manipulation of electrons and the burning of chemical energy sources that are the basis of our worldwide economy. It's why there are 7 billion people in this world. So I'm going to make a very shameless and baselessly optimistic guess that if intelligence arises, the time that it gets to the point that you develop advanced technology is 1.0. Once we develop that technology, as we saw last time, it provides a tremendous advantage to the species that does so. We went from a low-level population, roughly growing population of the Earth, but the development of technology 400 years ago at the beginning of the Renaissance saw an exponential growth in the numbers of the human species on this planet. So it's not surprising that technology provides such an advantage. It allows a species to break out of the biological portions of evolution and actually begin to evolve culturally and magnify the gifts of biology. Is so powerful that it is almost hard to believe, in perhaps a very provincial way, that this would not give advantages to any other species that's able to achieve technology. And if they achieve that technology, the question is, are they capable of communicating? And we'll say, sure, why not? Now, the last piece of the equation is, once a civilization achieves a certain level of technology, they're capable of transmitting their presence to the universe in the form of electromagnetic radiation. They can transmit radio signals, laser light blinkers, whatever you want. But it's basically using electromagnetic radiation, the primary way that information coded as energy is transmitted in our universe. The next question becomes, how long can they do that? What is the lifetime? How long does an advanced communicating civilization last? That is a difficult and, frankly, very uncomfortable question to guess at. Because it's one of those times when we're asking what is the mortality of our own species, not our individual mortality, which basically freaks everybody out who's self-aware. But now we're asking about the possible extinction of our own species. How long does our species last once we've achieved advanced technology? The only example we have to work with is ourselves. We have a lower bound on this. We know that we've lasted for at least 100 years with radio technology. So the number L is at least 100 years. The question is, how do we set the upper bounds? Is it next year? Is there an asteroid out there with our name on it? Is there a nutcase with his finger on the button? We don't know. Is it perhaps in 100 years? Another asteroid with our name on it? Ecological disaster? Biological disaster? A superbug that just won't die? The zombie apocalypse? You name it. What can happen to us in the next century? We don't know. Maybe too many madmen with their fingers on the buttons. We know that there are some other physical upper bounds set. For example, the habitable zone around the sun is going to change. It's going to move because the sun is evolving. The sun is actually steadily getting brighter. And in anywhere, depending upon how you set that habitable zone, between 500 million and 3 billion years in the future, the Earth is no longer going to be in the habitable zone. Of course, that doesn't rule out the possibility that we can't move. After all, 500 million years is an awfully long time compared to a species that has just dragged itself up out of the Stone Age in a little under 10,000 years. So what technologies would we possess a half a billion years into the future would probably be sufficient to at least go find a place that is habitable in our solar system, or perhaps even to find habitable places around other stars if we're patient enough and have the will. So maybe the upper limit could be set at 5 billion years. It's really quite difficult to know how to set this number, right? It comes down to the question of how often has this question been answered elsewhere in our galaxy. On how many worlds in our galaxy are there two vast and legless trunks of stone sitting in a vast desert, showing the signs of an ancient civilization? This is, by the way, the statue of Ozymandias, who otherwise known as Ramses II, sitting in an Egyptian desert. The inscription does not read, "Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair," but it might as well, because it's surrounded by an utterly trackless desert. How many worlds did this also happen? How long did those civilizations last before their mighty works are lost in a vast sea of sand? So let's put those numbers together and try to understand what this looks like. Let's take all those numbers I put together to come up with my shamelessly optimistic guess as to how the Drake equation runs out. We have about 100 billion stars. That's a reasonable averaging of stars that are capable of harboring life. We're going to ignore all the really big stars and the things that have died. We're going to say half of those stars are capable of building planetary systems. Of those that build planetary systems, there's always at least one Earth there, and that Earth is capable of harboring life. That the emergence of intelligence is probably less likely because of the contingencies of way in which life works. But if you get intelligence, you ultimately develop technology, because technology is a hell of a multiplier on biological evolution. And I'm going to set a lower bound saying, well, we made it at least this far for 100 years, so I'll plug in 100 years for the lifetime, and that allows me to go up. And finally, the age of the Milky Way, that's for all intents and purposes, I'm going to round off to 10 billion years because I just don't want to carry the fractions around. So I plug those numbers into this equation, and I end up with 50. So by these shamelessly optimistic estimates, and they're shamelessly optimistic, I'm giving a lot of benefit of the doubt to the presence of Earth-like planets with life, and I'm giving a fair amount of doubt to the emergence of technology once you have intelligence. There should be only, at this instant, 50 other intelligent communicating species within our galaxy. That's pretty optimistic. What does this mean when we actually apply that to our galaxy? What is 50 civilizations, 50 other possible technologies to talk with today? Well, we have to remember our galaxy is vast. The galaxy is a spiral galaxy, Milky Way. It's got a disk and a bulge of stars. It's about 100,000 light years across. So we can ask, well, what is the rough density of stars in the galaxy? The number of stars per unit volume through this flattened disk. That's the number of stars divided by, make a flat disk, which is going to be 550,000 light years in radius, 100,000 light years in diameter. And on average, it's about 1,000 light years thick. This is a rough and ready numerical estimate. It's not meant to be perfect. The density would be 50 civilizations divided by the volume of a flattened disk with height h and radius r. I punch those numbers through, and I end up with 6.4 times 10 to the minus 12 technological civilizations per cubic light year. What does that mean? Well, this means that the density is really low. This low density means that the civilizations are, on average, highly spread out through this 100,000 light year across disk. So the mean distance between those civilizations is going to be very large. Look around you today. Today is what I would call a relatively low density attendance day. Something like half of the class is here. So the mean distance between people in this room is about two or three chairs. Tomorrow, most everyone will show up, and the mean distance between chairs will be one. If you came, oh, say, a Friday not too long ago, the mean distance between chairs in here was more like three or four. The same thing is true now. The mean distance is going to be calculated by basically 1 over the density, square root. So I can run those numbers through. Don't worry about how I do this calculation. I'm just showing you it doesn't come out of the air. So It basically says, if the density of intelligent civilizations capable of communicating with radio technology that live 100 years today is 6.4 times 10 to the minus 12 per cubic light year, then the answer is going to be that the average distance between those civilizations is 7,000 light years. A two-way communication, hi, I'm here, so are we, takes 14,000 years round trip, 7,000 out, 7,000 back. Cool. Where can we go with this number? Well, there's one number to keep in mind at the back of our head for this one. We've had radio technology for 100 years. That means the first radio signals generated on the Earth have been moving outwards from the Earth at the speed of light for 100 years. Where is the outer edge of our radio sphere right now? 100 light years away. If the mean distance between technological civilizations is 7,000 light years, instantaneous communication is probably out of the question. We would have to last on, well, we would have to be around at least 7,000 years as a technological civilization for our signal to have arrived at them, and we are still transmitting to the first of those that might be out there. And we would have to last another 7,000 years or 14,000 years as a technologically advanced civilization to be around to receive the possible reply if they are actually listening. So the problem with this, with the Drake equation, is it's kind of a dismal answer in many ways. 50 civilizations sounds like a lot, and we are somewhat optimistic. We can actually make that number get bigger by allowing the number of civilizations to grow larger. To make this two-way communication to be correct, I do not have to have a 100-year lifetime, but I multiply by 14,000 years. Then I increase the number of possible civilizations, and I decrease the mean distance between them. And I'll leave as an exercise to those of you who like such speculations, how long does a technological civilization have to live that the average distance between them is amenable to round-trip communication? Answer, call, and response. So the Drake equation is a nothing more than a guide. Yes, sir? What's the question?
Do radio signals travel the speed of light or the speed of sound?
Speed of light. It's electromagnetic radiation, all forms of electromagnetic radiation, from radio waves, visible light, gamma rays, are all just different forms of light. They differ by having low to high energy. So what a radio wave is really extremely low energy light. And so, yes, it in fact travels at the speed of light. So the Drake equation is a guide. It's not an answer. It's just a guide to the numbers. And there are lots and lots of criticisms that have been laid against it, from being totally bogus to a good estimate but missing some things. One of the reasons why people have had a problem with the Drake equation is, as I think I just demonstrated, there's an awful lot of guesswork and conjecture involved. It relies on numbers that I've had to kind of wave my hands and tap my toes really fast at to come up with a number, and I just sort of, you know, pitch it in and put in one just so I can get an upper limit. It also doesn't account for something else. It doesn't account for population dynamics. It's an instantaneous measurement of the number of civilizations now. But it assumes intrinsically that those civilizations stay put. They just sit there on their planet listening for things and transmitting signals out, like, oh, say, the signal that you just received for your homework number 5 and are in the process of decoding. If, on the other hand, the civilizations do not stay put, that there is interstellar travel and ultimately interstellar colonization, that a single point of emergence of advanced technology can multiply itself through multiple stars, then I increase the fraction of technological civilizations because now it's not a one-off proposition. You have multiple copies. What's the good of that? It's a mainstay of science fiction. Pick a particular science fiction program. Firefly, right? Colonies from an old, dead Earth. But if the Earth is dead, the human civilization was not wiped out because humanity had the ability to go out and colonize multiple planets. When you can colonize multiple planets, you save yourself from the single point failure problem, right? If a madman hits the button today, that's it for humanity. If a madman hits the button 10,000 years from now, but 10,000 years from now there are human colonies on the first nearest five habitable planets around other stars, and you better believe that as soon as we discover a habitable planet within reach, we're probably going to try to figure out some way to get there, then the fact that the Earth went and pushed the button and left the cockroaches in charge, there's five other copies. And that's a multiplier on the Drake equation. The Drake equation does not account for population dynamics. So, despite its faults, it's the starting point. This is the lower. This is an upper limit, but in some sense, it could be a lower limit as well. So it gives you an idea of guidance. Space is vast. Time is deep. Civilization is fragile. We know that. We've seen multiple examples of, two vast and trunkless legs of stone in many deserts on our own planet. How many worlds do those emerge on? But it's a starting point for the discussion, so the class doesn't end here. The question is, what would life really be like out in the universe? Let's play that as a scientific question. And next week, what we're going to end this course with is trying to answer the question, or at least try to ask scientifically, are we alone? What are the implications of that? We'll see you all tomorrow on the exam.